Hello and welcome to One Shared Brain Cell. Slightly strange episode this week because I'm flying solo. Ellie is off on an 18 to 30 holiday, having it large in Ibiza somewhere, I think. I'm not sure. And God knows where Fee is. But I am joined by a fantastic guest to keep me company and have a proper natter with. And it is Nat from Cenozoic Lifebot. Hey, Nat, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Do you know, I'm okay, I think. I think I'm doing better than Fee is. She's got a very poorly arm because somebody banged into her car yesterday. I think she's got a broken wrist, I think. So poor Fee. Mm. But she's okay. She's, in good spirits, but just couldn't get here today, which is a bit of a shame.
Oh.
But that does mean I've got you all to myself.
Oh.
and you're okay, are you?
Oh, fantastic. Just busy as always.
Busy is good, I think. First of all, I always think of your name as being pronounced as Cenozoic Lifebot. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, because it's funny, because when you see names written down, you automatically presume you know how it's pronounced. Now, is that like a is there like a literary reference that I'm missing, or was that entirely like inspirational, or where did you come up with that name?
That was actually inspired by a couple of things. I came up with a Cenozoic Lifebot while I was at the University of Utah. I was taking a World of Dinosaurs class, and we were talking about geological periods, and I really took to the Cenozoic era, which is just basically the geological period that began around 66 million years ago. That's the first part of it. I was kind of a fossil nerd in college. I went through a phase where I was buying just tons of fossils off eBay. An addiction there. The second part, Lifebot, was actually inspired by Richard Dawkins. Like when I was in college, I was a big Richard Dawkins fan.
Oh, amazing.
I was at the time a hardcore atheist. I'd read The God Delusion, and I just thought Richard Dawkins was amazing. And I believe it was in The God Delusion, he had talked about how we as human beings are these beautiful genetic machines. And we have this programming, DNA, that we, pass on to other bodies as we have children and things like that. And I'm trying to remember exactly how he worded it, but I kind of spun it and said, okay, so we're like these really sophisticated life robots, life bots. So I just kind of sent you as an email address originally and just went with Cenozoic Lifebot. So
I really like that. That's had some thought into it. It's had some meaning as well. It's like it actually means like a lot to you, which I really like. I appreciate the name more than ever now.
Yeah. You're a Lifebot. I'm a Lifebot.
Yes, excellent. And I love Richard Dawkins too. I messaged him on I had this theory about how the Bible is, doesn't makes sense, and no one had ever said it. To my knowledge, no one's ever noticed it before, and I was like, I have spotted something no one else has. And you get all excited, you think, who can I tell? So I messaged Richard Dawkins on Instagram to say, I think I've spotted this. It's infallible as to why the Bible is nonsense. He didn't get back to me. He probably already knows it's nonsense, to be honest.
He's probably too busy reading his hate mail.
Yeah,
videos where he would read the hate letters he would get. Yeah, that was
it's shockingly bad, isn't it? Yes. From Christians. Yeah. So what would be great is if you could tell us something about animals on the subject of evolutionary and non-creationism. What you've got quite a selection of animals, I think, haven't you? Kind of pets and loved little ones.
Yes. So my partner, Cody, and I are primarily into tarantulas. We have an arachnid room in our home. I would say right now we have probably a couple hundred of them. Wow. In that room. So it's a pretty big collection. Years ago, we decided we wanted to be breeders. And we went out and bought just as many females as we could find, whatever we wanted to breed. And it's just kind of grown from there. Currently, we have two sets of slings in incubators right now.
Oh, is that the GBB and the Pyomenias?
The Pyomenias have been separated recently.
Oh, cool. So
they're good to go. They're ready to find homes.
Oh, nice.
The GBBs are still developing right now, so they're in the incubator. And then we tried to breed our Asian fawn or Chilibrachis. I'm going to slaughter this. Wahini. However you say that.
Well, that sounds good to me. That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So our Asian fawn, basically, we tried to pair our Asian fawn. She almost ate the sack. We grabbed it from her in time, but now that they're not developing into like eggs with legs, we suspect she probably had a good reason why she was eating that sack.
It's amazing how they know, isn't it? It's.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's because incredible.
They're largely regarded as like not particularly intelligent beings, aren't they? But I'm guessing that they must be instinctively natural. They must just know. I don't imagine that they do many tests to see if the egg sac is going to be sort of viable, but they just seem to know, don't they?
I think they do. I think instinctively the females know things about their sacks that maybe we don't pick up on. And I also think that when you're pairing, I don't know what your experience is with this, or Fiona's. I've heard that Fia's bred a little bit or a lot. I don't know. But you can tell when I honestly think that the males sense things with the females that either attracts them or deters them.
Okay.
So sometimes you'll put like a male and a female together and they'll do a little bit of tapping. Maybe the female will reciprocate. Maybe she won't. But I swear that sometimes the males will pick up signals from the female and they'll say, I don't want to do this, and they'll bounce. We have learned, at least over the years that we've been doing pairings, is that if the males don't want to do it, if they don't want to do the pairing, there's probably a good reason. If you pressure them into it too much, there's a chance they might get eaten. And that was why they didn't want to do it. So it's a very pressure thing. You know, pressure-free thing.
How many pairings have you done now, would you say?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you, honestly, over the years.
It's a lot. It's a lot, then. It's an awful lot.
Yeah.
It's not something I've ever done. I don't have it in me to do pairings. Like you say, I know Fee's done a couple, maybe. I know she's done jumping spiders, but, I'm sure she's done tarantulas as well, but no, I don't have it in me to do it. I just don't know. I don't know if I'm just too squirmish or too squeamish or just, I can't do it. I don't know what it is. Even my mature males, I just sort of, they're just there to live their lives in comfort. I can't, it's funny, isn't it? Because breeding is, it must be a rewarding thing. And it must be a nice feeling to be contributing towards the hobby as well.
I think it's magical. I think when you're a tarantula keeper and you start reading and you get your, like, you get your first sack, even just going through the steps, like finding, if you have a male and you're trying to find a female, or you have a female and you're trying to find a male, pairing them, watching the female close off her burrow and create the actual sack, and then sit on the sack and, you know, pulling the sack and seeing what comes out of it. The whole thing, I think for keepers, it puts you on a whole other level, because you get to see behaviors that you wouldn't normally get to see with, like, just a male or just a female.
That's very true. I hadn't thought of it like that, actually. Yeah. It's fascinating to hear about, because, as I say, it's not something I've ever experienced, and no one's ever spoken about it in those sort of terms before. No one's ever spoken it about that way before. It's interesting.
Oh, it's fascinating. And I will say this, the cool thing is, with every species that you pair, the males and the females have different rituals. Like, it's the same process. Like, the male goes up to the burrow and starts tapping and dancing. But the way that the males go about it, I swear that it's, a lot of them are species specific. Some will, shake their rumps, like do a little ass shake.
Oh, wow.
Some will do like more of a tap or a jiggle. Like, it's just, it's really cool to witness that.
Which are your favorite species to pair then?
I think so far, that's a hard one. I would say I'm going to have to think about this for a second. I'm going to go with this. Just recently, so right now we're trying to pair orange tree spiders, or Amazonius germanis. And the male that we have, before he goes down into the female's little tree trunk that we've set up, he does a little, a little butt shake. Like, he doesn't really tap, but he does like a little butt shake, almost.
Oh, that's so
like
cute.
He's kind of jiggling or twerking. I think that's my favorite right now. Because I've never seen that before. Most of the time I see the males do like a little tap, 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 you know, like they're drumming.
Yeah.
But he does a little butt shake.
That's really cool. Are there any species that you wouldn't breed or you wouldn't want to breed?
Honestly, Cody and I tend to kind of stay in our lane as far as tarantulas versus true spiders. I think we're a little intimidated by the true spiders, like the huntsman species and things like that, just because they are so fast. They are true teleporters. So we just kind of, we admire, a lot of the true spiders, but we kind of stay in our lane with the tarantula species. I would say we're comfortable with really breeding any tarantula species.
Oh, amazing. And you've always got your hands full, because there's so many tarantulas to breed, aren't there?
Yes, currently.
Do you have breeding tarantulas and pet tarantulas then? Do you have both? Do you have family, and then do you have like business partner tarantulas?
I would say all of our personal tarantulas, which are most of them, they're just pets. We love them. If we get the opportunity to do a pairing with someone like a local breeder in our state, we'll do it. We have a couple of females that are temporarily staying with us that actually belong to TJ Rousel over at Salt Lake Underground Tarantulas. He's a local breeder here in Utah. A couple of his females are staying with us temporarily. But honestly, it's as far as like husbandry and all of that, I treat everyone just like they're our pets. Nice. So I do go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I get so excited when I'm hearing things that are just really interesting. So I'm going to say, so they're all family members then. Do you feel like a grandparent when they have their little slings, when the sort of eggs and the legs start to emerge? Do you feel like pride grandparents?
Kind of, yeah. I guess I guess we do, because you feel this magic. Like you know, you open up, like you open up the sack, and Cody is really, I mean, he is so good at opening up sacks. He's just kind of developed a knack for it. He's very delicate and he uses tweezers, and it's just kind of magical. That moment you open up a sack and you see like the little eggs with legs moving.
Oh,
I was like, oh, you're all so cute.
Nice. Oh, and do you, are these, is this to sort of, well, to sell, or to, do you sort of furnish, retailers, wholesalers with them, or is it sort of a part of a business project for you as well?
We kind of furnish, like we pretty much furnish like retailers, other breeders. We don't do a business of our own. We mostly do it for fun, and we get a little bit of money on the side. So we'll sell locally, like in our little area, our little neighborhood. We have a lot of keepers. There are a lot of keepers in breeder Utah. So oftentimes we'll take the bulk of what we have. Let's say we're successful with a sack. If we have a relationship with another local breeder, we'll usually split them, or we'll give most of them to the breeder, depending on the relationship. So like TJ at Salt Lake Underground Tarantulas, he's an actual retailer. So he goes to exhibits, he goes to booths, you know, he goes out and sells. It's nice to be able to kind of to breed, and then be able to kind of load those off onto him, let him do his thing, and we just kind of sell locally.
That's amazing. Imagine how many pet tarantulas. Imagine how many pets out there have come from your breeding projects, from your family. You know, if you've been doing it for years, and you've got to imagine that there's so many eggs that have been out there, and slings and spiderlings that have been sold. There's got to be so many pets out there that have come from your hands. It's amazing, isn't it? It's like, imagine where they all are over the states. Like you could have one of your tarantulas in every state.
I would imagine that, especially with like LPs, Lasiodora parahibanas. You know, our female, the last time she dropped a sack, there were over 2,000 eggs in that sack. And they've all got to go somewhere. They've all got to, you know, find homes.
Where do you get enough pots from? You must be you must have such a stack of pots.
Oh, just, I would say Amazon is our best friend as far as like cups and rehousing materials. You could just, you know, order them, they'll come in a couple of days.
Amazing.
So yeah,
wow. It's so fascinating to hear about. Do you have lovebirds? Is it lovebirds?
Yes.
Yep. And it was fairly recently that they had babies, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, was that a planned project, or was that just lovebirds doing their thing?
That was lovebirds doing their thing.
Oh, amazing. Because those little birdlets were so adorable, weren't they? And they just had the videos I was seeing, they had such little personalities as well. And did you keep any, or did they all go to homes?
They actually went, they all three of them went to one home.
Oh, amazing.
Yes.
Oh, that's really cool. So they say there's chances are they're just going to do their thing again then? Or did they not do that sort of thing?
You know, that was kind of a happy little accident. I didn't anticipate that happening, and neither did Cody. So after we got the babies rehomed, the three baby lovebirds rehomed, we immediately started making attempts to separate them. So what I ended up doing was going and getting an enclosure. It's the same enclosure, but it has a barrier between the two. I think it's a breeding enclosure. And unfortunately, I have to separate them. And I also have to chaperone them because they will they keep trying. They're frisky little birds. They'll be sitting up in a high space and they try to do their thing, and you have to tell them, knock it off, don't do that.
Wow. Was it like a learning? Was it a learning curve then? Because you're obviously massively experienced with tarantula breeding. Was it all of a sudden like, what do we do? We've got it's a new thing.
Absolutely. It was kind of terrifying because birds are not our specialty.
Like it went well though. It looks like it went very well.
I did a lot of research on my own, but I also decided to allow those three lovebirds to be parent raised, where basically mom and dad just kind of took the reins and fed them and kept them warm. I just made sure there was plenty of fresh water, feed. And I also kind of adapted their nest based on their growth. Like as they were growing, I would go and change things out. And I think it seemed to go really well.
So you sort of did everything that mum and dad couldn't do. You know, you did the sort of infrastructure support, whereas mum and dad did the raising to some extent then.
Yes, and I did that because I did try to do the temporarily, I tried to do the hand feeding or the feeding with the syringe, and the babies had been fed so much by their mother that they weren't, you know, really taking it. Mm. But when they went back to their mother, just the amount of food that Mango and Tango, mom and dad, were shoveling into their little mouths was incredible. I couldn't even compete with that.
They know what they're doing, don't they? They really do know what they're doing.
Yeah, I'll just let them take over. I kind of got worried near the end because the thing that we learned with, at least with our lovebirds, is once the female wants them out of the nest, she wants them out of the nest.
Oh, really?
Yes. She started getting a little aggressive with the babies because they wanted to stay with mom in the nest, and she kind of wanted them to get out so she could lay more eggs.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we separated them. We found them, the three babies, an amazing home. We had a local lady whose bird had recently passed away. I guess she'd been keeping birds for years, and her daughters wanted to surprise her with some new birds. And so they took all three. They seemed to go to a really good home. So we were so really lovely. Happy with that.
Yeah, that's such a lovely thing, isn't it? Yeah. Are there any animals that you haven't bred or haven't owned that you'd either want to keep or want to breed?
I would say probably not currently at this time. I feel like our little ark here is pretty full. We have this, you know, we have our tarantulas, which is our main thing. We have our lovebirds. And then of course we have, you know, snakes. We just have basic snakes. Like we have a couple ball pythons, king snakes, a corn snake. We recently were gifted 10 baby hog noses.
Oh, wow.
Just a local breeder over in Grantsville, Utah, was extraordinarily kind. We gave him some free tarantulas. I think we gave him some free slings. And he reciprocated with, you know, literally 10 baby hog noses. We left his and his wife's home kind of shell-shocked. I'd always wanted a hog nose, but I was like, wow, 10. Okay, well.
What's better than one hog nose? Yeah. What's better than one hog nose? 10 hog noses.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you notice differences in the personalities between, it's like if looking at the three, I think like ball pythons, corn snakes, and hog noses are three very popular snakes in the community, aren't they? And
yes.
I had a corn snake for a while, and it was the most adorable personality. Do you find that there's characteristic traits between those three?
Oh, absolutely. I think all of our snakes have different personalities, and then of course they have their things that are specific to their species. So hoggies or hog noses tend to do the thing where they will musk you if they feel threatened. They'll secrete this little liquid all over your hands.
Lovely.
They're adorable. So it's not really threatening. And then of course they play dead. They'll try to roll over on their back, I'm dead. Don't touch me.
My overwhelming memory of and whenever I think of hog noses is Fee posting videos saying, walked past Tofu's enclosure today, she hissed at me and lunged at me. It's like they just seem like really stroppy little gits. They're adorable looking, but they just seem so angry.
Oh, yes. It's interesting, between the 10 of these that we have, even within that, that group, we have some that are more docile. You can just pick them up. They'll smell you a little bit. They'll wrap their little tails around your finger, just kind of hang out. And then you have some that just strikes, moment they see you, they just strike it. And it doesn't matter how gentle you are or how careful you are. They just have that more defensive nature.
Do you find them more easily to get attached to because they do things like wrap their little tails around you, and they will physically, encounter you? Do you find them more easy to get attached to, or do you get attached to tarantulas the same way, even though you can't really cuddle them the sort of same way you can a snake?
I would say it's, for me personally, it's really easy for me to become emotionally attached to all of our snakes, especially the hoggies, our corn snake, and our ball pythons, because they are more affectionate. They will wrap themselves around you. We have a large female ball python that we'll take her out for movie time. Take her, and she'll just, she'll just lay around your neck and just kind of get snuggled in and stay there for, a whole movie. Whereas I think that tarantulas, at least in our experience, it seems like they are running more on instinct.
Yes. I think you've hit the nail on the head there, definitely. They are very instinctive, aren't they? They are. They're great if they're calm when they come out, and they're not subject to any sort of environmental triggers, being breathed on or anything, any bangs or loud noises or anything. I think they're, because I kind of see the shockwaves, I guess, isn't it? They feel in their hairs. But yeah, they're great if they're really calm when they come out, and they have such little personalities, don't they? But
oh, absolutely. Maybe five Gramostola porteri females in our arachnid room. And all of them, they're all, really docile for the most part, but they all still have their own little, temperaments. Mm. If I go to open this enclosure and I go to try to feed this one might get, might react this way or that way. Same with OBTs. We have a couple of OBTs in our arachnid room, and they're all kind of different. Most of them are a little on the defensive side. You open the enclosure, and here comes the threat pose and the fangs. Look at me. But in the past we had a tan color form OBT, who was really docile, like an older adult female. She wasn't really defensive with us. Kind of more relaxed, slow moving. And then of course you have, your males and any male tarantula, they tend to, of course, be a little more handleable because, after they mature, they're ready to go do their thing.
Yeah. They've got a wanderlust, haven't they? Yeah.
So you pick, it's really, at least for me, it's really easy for me to, pick them up, at least the new worlds. I don't really pick up the old worlds. No. But the new world males, I'll pick them up. And I think in some way they don't feel like affection, but they know, oh, I think I'm being taken somewhere to go mate. Here we go.
Word gets around. It's like, it's my turn.
Yes.
I'm on a date tonight. I agree with you. I think that I would never contemplate holding or take or going anywhere. I'm always careful when I put my hands into an old world enclosure, but most of them I find are much more defensive in terms of hiding. I think you'll often struggle to see an old world tarantula, let alone, get threat posed by one. Like as soon as you lift, if you've got pokies, as soon as you go anywhere near the enclosure or lift the lid,
yep, it's
they are gone. You can sort of fill up water bowls and water dishes and safety because then they know where near you. Yeah. I've had maybe three or four OBTs now, and I always think that they're an amazing part of the hobby and the tarantula keeping hobby because whenever you get into the hobby or you're sort of on YouTube and you Google certain tarantulas, you'll always see the idiot OBT keepers that sort of rile them up just so they live up to their reputation, and you'll see them going mad in like a plastic bowl because that's what the guy wants to do to give it sort of some sort of characteristic of being angry. But when you own them, you realize they're nothing like that. It's like if they're well kept, the only time I've ever had a threat pose from an OBT was when I didn't realize I was pouring water on it when I was filling the bowl up. Because you've always got to look and see if you can see where they are, haven't you? So I looked in, I could see this orange blob, and I thought, okay, there he is at the back. And then as I started pouring the water, and I realized he was facing the way that I was pouring the water, not the other way. So I was actually sort of half pouring it on him, and then quite rightly, he gave me the old threat pose, and I was like, fair shout, you're perfectly entitled to.
Exactly.
I felt like I wanted to apologize. I was like, I am so sorry. I think it's one of those parts of the hobby that's such a brilliant learning curve because you're like, do you know what? These are actually brilliant tarantulas.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I think that's the case definitely with our female HMAC. A lot of people seem to be really afraid of HMACs in particular. Really they're just, they have this big bad reputation because of their venom, but they're really just so shy and reclusive.
Yeah.
Stay out of their way, they'll stay out of your way.
That's it, isn't it? Their reputation comes a lot from the venom, isn't it? Like you say, there's like Escalciatums as well. They are, right up there in terms of venom strength, venom potency. But again, you might well struggle to see one if you keep one because they are, they'll happily hide from you if they can, but they do have, and cobalt blues as well. Is it the Cnividus? They are beautiful, and they're up there with the bad reputation bad boys, aren't they? Because they, again, people like to sort of hype up the danger of the tarantula keeping hobby, which is there's no harm in having. In fact, it's quite healthy to have a good respect for a tarantula, but you don't want to sort of give it a reputation it doesn't deserve, do you?
Oh, absolutely. It's, I think that, the cobalts just, we have a couple of of Earth tigers, I think the Asian fawn tends to have that reputation as well, just because they are so fast. You know, those gosh darn teleporting species, they, you know, they react, they move before you can react. But if you set them up correctly, where they have a place to hide and they feel safe, you're not going to see those behaviors.
Normally. That's exactly it. I agree 100% with you. If the tarantula is well looked after and it's happy and it's got everything it needs, and particularly a hiding place that it feels safe, then, yeah, you're not going to... It doesn't need to threat pose. It doesn't need to kick hairs. It doesn't need to lunge for you because, you know, it isn't being... just isn't designed to have that that nature, is it? It's, you know, you're trying to keep it placid and calm so it has a better life and, you know, you don't need clean pants every time you fill the water bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about responsible... good responsible keeping. I think it's, you know, it's got to be tarantula care first, hasn't it, really?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it comes down to, I can see how people can, some keepers can become a little bit complacent sometimes. Cody and I kind of go through this together because when we met, we were already keepers. When we started dating, I had already gotten into old worlds quicker than he did. He kind of stuck to new worlds. And so he's always been a little more cautious with the old worlds. A couple of times when I've been really like comfortable with a particular old world, maybe they're, you know, on the other side of the enclosure or they're in their burrow or I'm not anywhere near them. And I've, you know, gone in real quick and grabbed something with tongs or gotten really close, you know, he'll go, ah, 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 please don't do that.
Yeah, it is. I think complacency is the key, isn't it? You kind of can't switch off, can you, really? It's like,
it's, you know, hard. You have to remind yourself. I'm guilty of it. You know, we all make mistakes. Sometimes we learn the hard way. We had a breeder I think a few years ago who stuck his hand in, he was trying to grab a water dish or something. He reached into his P. metallica's enclosure, his female's enclosure, and he assumed, well, she's, you know, just in her burrow. I'm just going to, you know, reach in here real fast to just grab this thing and pull it back out. And just, you know, just before he could react, he had his, you know, hand down in there and she just tagged him. She bounced out, tagged him and went back in.
Well, an actual bite or?
Yes.
An
actual bite. And he he did a I don't know if he did a YouTube video or a bite report on like arachnoboards, but he told all of us about it. He went like hour by hour and it really wasn't as bad as other people have reported. So he said it was painful for the first couple of hours, but then things pretty quickly started to kind of tone down. But he learned a lesson. About being complacent. And this is somebody who has been breeding for a long time, somebody who's been in the hobby for years.
It just goes to show, doesn't it? It's experience and complacency shouldn't always go hand in hand, should they? It's did you say it was a new to him tarantula, or had he had it a while?
Oh, he'd had it a while. He'd had her for years. He felt like he was pretty comfortable with her behavior. And I think that's what happens is you get a feel for your tarantula's, your animal's temperament, and you think, oh, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to come out. They're not going to.
I know this tarantula. It's tarantula and I are friends. Yeah.
Right. Like, I know this animal. It's not even like anthropomorphizing their behavior. It's just like, I know this animal's temperament, and they can surprise you.
I think where that sort of it gets interesting is between molts, because Yes. You can definitely see a change in temperament and characteristic after a malt, can't you? Like Flo, my prized daughter, my Jeep Ulcra, she malted, I'm going to say, in the last month, and she has become so nervous and shy after her last malt. She's gone from being out and I wouldn't think twice about picking up her water bowl an inch away from her because she is so calm, to a point where now I can't even sort of open the enclosure next to her without her hiding and running off. And it's like, I'm putting it down to the malt, because I say she wasn't like that until she just recently came out from her hiding spot. It's amazing how you have to get to know them again. It's like, okay, we've had a malt. How are you now? You know, it's you have to get to re-know them. But
we actually had that happen with one of our male pulchras just like years ago. This animal was really, for the most part, pretty docile, pretty easy to deal with. As soon as he matured and, you know, earned his boxing gloves, if you will, he was a completely different animal, very defensive, you know, just very, very bitey, constant, you know, threat posturing, not the same animal before the molt.
I suppose he got his grown-up attitude, did he? He's like, I've got to fend off rivals attitude, did he, I guess?
Yes. Yeah. I remember one time I think I went into that and into his enclosure to just like change out a water dish or something, or remove a bolus. It was something very simple. And he just came, you know, marching out of the top of that enclosure. And I very gently put, some tongs in front of him to kind of, get him to go, oh, okay, that's something I don't recognize. He just marched right over the tongs. He didn't care. He was on his way out.
he had his determination, and that was that.
Yep.
there's something that there's a topic I'm fascinated by. Not entirely pet related, although maybe one day. Now you live somewhere near the Rockies or in the Rockies, don't you?
Part of our mountain system in Utah is known as the Wasatch Front, and it's part of the Rocky Mountain system. Yes.
Now, is that Bigfoot territory? Is that Bigfoot country?
Allegedly, yes.
Excellent. Are you a believer? Do you think that Bigfoot is out there?
Honestly, I don't know. It's something I would have to experience for myself. I know people who have allegedly had experiences with Bigfoot. We have a couple of places. Just kind of right in our neighborhood, we have this canyon area. It's a really popular place to go snowmobiling. It's called Monte Cristo, up here in northern Utah. And allegedly, people have had Bigfoot sightings there. Okay. I personally haven't seen anything. And, you know, as a kid, we used to go snowmobiling during the winter, just out and about and... you know, a lot of people go cross country skiing in that area and they haven't seen anything, but some people have. So it's just, I think with the whole Bigfoot thing, it seems like there are a couple of different camps that you can be in. My understanding is you either don't believe at all. you are in the camp where Bigfoot is a physical primate, you know, it has blood, hair, fur, you know, it is a physical being and there should be traces of it. And then of course there's the camp where it's like interdimensional.
That's kind of where I start to have difficulties. I really want to believe that there is a sort of forgotten primate out there that's a bit bigger than we've ever seen before. And, you know, it's just very good at being hidden. Obviously, living in the UK, I've had no experience of it other than what I've seen on TV, and I am always willing for them to find it. But as soon as they start talking about, oh, yeah, it can go invisible, and, oh, yeah, it can shapeshift, and, oh, yeah, it comes from a different dimension, or I think Bigfoot are aliens, which I suppose is plausible. But yeah, it starts to sort of, it goes from being, okay, let's, if we do this scientifically, we might prove its existence, to, okay, well, you're just sort of making up lore now, aren't you? It's like, yeah. But I so want there to be a Bigfoot. I would... You know, and I it's one of those things you can get fascinated into it, and people say, oh, why are there no Bigfoot bones? And then you see people explaining that you very rarely see remains and bones of many animals when you consider how many wild animals there are in the forests and in America. And they were saying that you very rarely find the bones of any animal because they all get used. They just get, you know, they just get eaten and, you know, absorbed by nature. And you know, right. I can sort of see that if they don't, unless they die in a, you know, in the middle of a bowling green, then yeah, the chances are that a Bigfoot isn't going to get found even after it has passed away. But yeah, I do. The only thing that kind of, it's like the whole ghost thing, which is something else that fascinates me. I always tend to think that with Bigfoot, everyone's got a camera now. Everyone's got a good digital camera on them at all times now. Why haven't we seen any better video footage? But then if I do see good video footage, I'll then go, oh, that's a man in a suit. That's faked. You know, it's like I kind of
I want
to believe, but then I'm also far too much of a skeptic at the same time.
Oh, and my understanding is if you, you know, get into, I know there are specific groups on Facebook where you can get into these debates with people. And it's, I mean, people really get into, to some heavy arguments about this, you know, footage, like the, we had a guy here in Utah in Provo who allegedly saw a Bigfoot. And I think I sent you the link to the actual video. I filmed it going up a canyon, like, I think it was Provo Canyon. So he filmed it and he, you know, swore up and down it was, you know, a Bigfoot. And then I think a professor from the University of Utah came out and said, oh, there's just, you know, there's no way. There's just absolutely no way. That's physically impossible. You know, it has to be a hoax. There's just no absolute, you know, physical way. And that kind of put a little damper on his story. But then the paranormal group stepped in. like, I don't know if you're familiar with Monsters Among Us.
I'm not sure I've seen that one.
It's basically a podcast where people call in with their stories. So you just listen to people's like cryptid stories, ghost stories, alien stories.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but the guy who actually hosts that show, Derek Hayes, actually kind of swooped in and came to the witness's defense and kind of clapped back at the University of Utah professor and said, you yourself don't know what he saw. You don't know what he saw. You weren't there. It's a subjective experience.
That's true. Yeah. An experience you have is very subjective, isn't it? And the same thing might be viewed completely differently by two different observers as well, mightn't it? Because it is so entirely subjective. But in my head, I've got this amazing sort of daydream that in like 100 years' time, there's going to be people with pet Bigfoots, and they're going to be like, "Can you believe? Like 100 years ago, we didn't even know these existed." It's going to, you know, if they are out there, they will be found, I'm sure.
What expo can I get that at?
Exactly. Yeah, they'll just be like tarantulas. They'll just be the new species. They'll be arboreal species. They'll be the terrestrials. It's going to be.
These are the fossorial ones. They dig deep burrows. You only see them at night.
Imagine the size of the enclosure. It's going to be amazing. Fantastic. What we also like to do, if we can, we always like to ask our guests if they have something that they'd like to get off their chest, complain about, something they see in the community but don't enjoy. And we also like them to celebrate a keeper or an account they really enjoy as well. So whichever way you want to do it, do you want to get the good out of the way or do you want to start with the bad? Whichever way you want to do it, if you want to give us something that about the community that you don't like and somebody that you'd like to celebrate.
You know, I would say as far as the only bad thing, it's not even really a bad thing. I would say being in the hobby almost, 13 years. The only thing I would say is, kindness and reciprocity go a long way in the hobby. So if you are kind to another keeper, it goes a long way versus, bullying, being negative, picking on people for making mistakes. We're all human.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of things that you see online, when you see that somebody has successfully had an egg sack, or maybe they've fouled up, or it seems like they never foul up. Maybe they seem perfect. It's, that's not always the big picture. I think about times that, at least locally, we have our local tarantula groups here in Utah, and in the past, we would see what people would post and go, oh, they're so, they're so perfect. They're so look at all these sacks they're pulling. And then when you get them in a private conversation, maybe they come to your house to do a breeding project or something, like they bring a male. And they'll say, oh, man, I made this mistake years ago, or this happened, or this failed. You're not seeing that because it's a private conversation. Mm-hmm. Everybody makes mistakes. We've made mistakes. It would be nice if people, didn't bully each other as much. I agree.
Yeah, that's a really nice positive thing to dislike. I can't know if that sounds makes sense, but anti-community is it's not something we've ever discussed before that I can think of. We've discussed certain elements of that are bad within the community, but the actual sort of lack of community spirit is you're right, it's something that's just not needed, is it? It's like the community is so much better when everyone supports it and when everyone is positive, because as you say, we all make mistakes, and sometimes it's nice to sort of highlight and say, I've made this mistake. And sometimes I can understand why people don't want to, because, they feel like they may have gone past where they should be making those mistakes. They might be a little embarrassed maybe. But yeah, I think, you've got to sort of say, we've all made mistakes and everyone should admit to it, because I'm pretty certain we sort of all have. And I think, it's bullying anywhere is just not on, but within a sort of community of people that are passionate about the same things, it's incredibly negative, because it will put new keepers off. And what I always think as well is, if parts of the hobby are really off-putting and abrasive, you might have a new keeper that has a genuine question they want to ask, and they're too afraid because they've had a bad experience within the community, and that might then jeopardize the welfare of the tarantula. And I think that's the last thing we want as a community, isn't it? It's, if you're going to sort of be part of the active, community and sort of be available in the community, you should at least uphold the basics of human decency and respect when talking to anyone. I think, I think that's a really good point. I think, that's nice. I think, and it's one of those points that we don't often think about, but is always in the back of your mind somehow. It's like, man, that person was horrible. Why were they such a dick? New keepers and inexperienced keepers and just don't deserve to be treated badly, do they?
Oh no, I think about when I was first in the hobby. Back when I was in school, and My first exposure to the tarantula community was actually the Facebook group for the British Tarantula Society.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know at the time that there were like groups in the United States, or I hadn't searched them. I thought it was mostly just a kind of a European thing. And so I joined the British Tarantula Society when I first started. And at the time, I could just, you know, it was an environment where I could just ask questions and people were really polite and it was really positive. It was a really good experience for me. But then eventually I joined, you know, an American group, my own people. First, like, day I got into the group, it was like an immediate throat punch. Like, that fear's too big. You need more substrate.
Really? Oh, that's just
you
not
don't know
on,
how to.
I always think that of Facebook. I always think Facebook is advice with a punch in the face. It's like, you know, it's vicious, Facebook, isn't it? That's why I way prefer Instagram. It's just such a nicer community, I think.
Me too. I think about it's with, like, with the bullying and stuff. It's, you know, it's not just animals. It's pretty much everything. Like, I have a great example. So, my partner Cody is really into kettle cooking. Like, he has like the little barbecue, little round barbecue.
Oh, yeah, kettles. Yeah.
Loves barbecuing. And he joined a little kettle group, right? And people will, you know, cook up these ribs, brisket, you know, chicken, turkeys, whatever. And they're really proud. And they post a picture of their meat, you know, the meat that's like, look at this, look what I cooked. It, you know, I'm so proud of it. It tastes so good. And he was telling me about how people actually get bullied for their, you know, for what they cooked. And it's like, you're not eating it. Like, yeah, why are you getting mad?
That is so terrible. That's just like, I can't even reason why someone would want to literally piss on someone else's barbecue. It's like, no, just be supportive or say nothing. You don't have to, people don't post things just to people to go, oh, that's amazing. But they also don't want to post things that they're really proud of just for someone to go, oh, that's shit, mate. You know, it's like, yeah, if you're not going to post something positive, even if it's just a little thumbs up or it looks nice, you know, it's, that's all it takes, because everyone feels so much better with a little bit of pride and self-esteem, don't they? You know, it's like,
oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think this thing, and I can speak to this from both sides. I was, you know, somebody in the, when I started in the hobby, I didn't know any better. I was learning. I, you know, tried to be nice to, you know, local breeders, and some of them weren't very nice to me. And I think what ended up happening, at least with me, was I got angry. And I, once I got a little bit more knowledge, I started passing the torch. And, you know, in certain circumstances, not being so nice to other people for different reasons. And I think it's very easy to pass the torch. And if you just don't pass the torch, that's the key.
Yeah, you know, have a bit of, you know, be a bit stronger than they were, have a bit better character than they were. And also, you know, when you're coming up and like you're now a very experienced, prolific breeder, you've now got the power to go, do you know what, you're a dick, I don't want to deal with you. Or, you know, you're in a position now where you can like go, do you know what, I didn't like how you spoke to me, so I'm really not going to get involved with you. And it kind of does come around, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think the further you get into the hobby, the more experience you get, you know, you see things that people do in it. And, you know, I love the way Tom Moran put this years ago from Tom's Big Spiders. He said, you know, sometimes, you know, people will people, and there's nothing that you can really do about it. So just, you know, try to be a little bit forgiving. Or at least just if they're doing something really stupid, just don't give it any attention. Just walk away.
That's really good advice. That's a good, that's a sound way of looking at things. So on the subject of sound ways of looking at things, who would you like to celebrate? Who's somebody that you admire in the hobby?
I would say, honestly, I would say probably I'm, you know, kind of a fangirl of Tom Moran. I know that sometimes he will go on these little tea spilling, you know, rants on his podcast. But his content is so wonderful, especially his on his website where he has the beginner section. And he has everything laid out for a new keeper, you know, enclosure size, behavior. He has so much content to draw from. Oftentimes, when Cody and I sell a you know, like a sling to a new keeper, we'll tell, you know, we'll give them all the references and we'll say, go to, you know, Tom Moran's website and look at the beginner guide. Just read the beginner guide and start from there. And it seems like based on the feedback, you know, we get from these keepers that it gives them a lot of confidence. And I just think it's so wonderful that he has all those resources out there for people. And he himself also tends to be very forgiving. As amazing. Far as, yeah.
I need to look into Tom Moran more. It's like, I always hear his name spoken very reverentially, and I'm shockingly really unfamiliar with him. I, you know, it's I've heard that he has strong opinions, but then, you know, if they're well thought out and well, and they're his beliefs, then, you know, why shouldn't he have strong opinions? And everything I've heard about him has been amazing. So I must get into looking at his content and listening to his podcast is, you know, it's up there, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's an amazing podcast from what I hear. I think, you know, it's
I think he's one of those people, if you can look beyond the tea spilling and the rants and stuff, just go, okay, Tom. Yeah, okay, Tom. That's fine. That's fine, Tom. Let's carry you know, brilliant. Let's get to the good stuff. You know, that's fine.
Maybe he just needs a hug. Maybe at that point in the podcast, exactly, Someone just needs to come on and go, come on, Tom, be okay. Be okay, but, Tom. And then that won't happen.
Oh, and if you interact with him directly, if you email him to ask him a question, he is so friendly. Like, he's totally receptive. He will bend over backward to answer your question or find someone to answer your question.
Well, you can't ask for a better quality, you know, personality qualities than that, can you? One-on-one, he is kind and helpful and considerate. That's a brilliant reference for anyone's sort of character, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would say probably the other person, maybe from, like, you know, your side of the pond, who I admire is Andrew Smith. I just absolutely love his documentaries. I love what he has done as far as educating people, taking people to places where these tarantulas that we own actually live. I can't wait for him to do I heard that he was working on an Earth Tiger documentary.
Okay.
I don't know if that's still in the work, but I have all of his DVDs so far. He's very, like, he's very quirky and, you know, and funny. He's almost kind of comical to watch at times. He just has this cute little, you know, quirkiness about him, but he's just so brilliant, and there's so much to learn.
Somebody else I'm not massively familiar with, I've seen him pop up on YouTube, on either people mentioning his videos or his books. I must acquaint myself. This is why I kind of love the community spirit, because you can have a conversation and, you know, all of a sudden you've got a load of things that you want to look into more and people that you want to sort of learn more about, which is only going to expand an individual's knowledge and experience of the hobby, which is only a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think his documentary he did specifically about pokies, and then the documentary he did specifically about P. muticus, or the king baboon tarantula, is fascinating because he goes over the whole history of that spider and how it was discovered, how they discovered, you know, nails walking on the ground, and how a lot of researchers back in the day thought that the female king baboon was actually an entirely different species because they found it on the ground. They had to dig for it because the females don't normally come up. And then they realized, oh, these are actually the same species. This is the male and this is the female.
It's amazing how much work goes on outside of our own. You know, there are some amazing people working in the community at such lengths and at such great distances to expand everyone's knowledge. It's amazing. I mean, I love being able to talk to different people about the hobby and the science behind the hobby to a certain extent, though I don't really have the brain capacity to get into it too scientifically. I'm way more of a pet keeper. It's just amazing how much these dedicated people want to expand the knowledge for everyone. And that's hugely to be commended, isn't it? Because tarantula keeping... Sorry, yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, you're good. You're good.
Tarantula keeping, it's one of those, it's not even like a romantic hobby. It's not like people, it's not like hand gliding or parachuting where people go, oh, wow, that's not a thing to be doing. You talk to people about tarantulas and they're like, oh, no, horrible. So it's like they're doing it in a hobby they are 100% passionate about, and they're not doing it for any glory. They're just doing it because they're so passionate about it, isn't it? You know, it's not, you know, it's, there's no glory in anything to do with tarantulas apart from people that love tarantulas.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's where Tom Moran kind of falls into. He doesn't make any money. He doesn't profit from his content at all. He just puts it out there because he happens to be a school teacher. He loves teaching people. But he's also passionate about his tarantulas. And so he has all this free content, all of these resources that you can go learn from him.
And amazing. That's what the community needs, isn't it? It's what the hobby needs. Yeah. I'm really glad that you've given two such inspirational and names that I'm going to have to look up further and become more acquainted with. Thank you.
Oh, I promise you won't be disappointed, especially Andrew Smith. His documentaries, just actually going to the places where these animals are. It's neat because he actually goes and finds them in those locations and talks to the people he is a great well to draw from.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Well, Nat, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a genuine pleasure because I think you and I have been sort of chatting and nattering and saying hello for probably a year or two now, I would
say. Yeah.
Yep. So it's really nice to have a proper chat and to sort of get to know you better. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. Well, thank you everyone for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed, I hope you have enjoyed me and our Ellie not being here, but I hope I hope that Nat and I have kept you entertained. So thanks for joining us and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.